on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial President, Portfolio Manager Steve Peasley.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Invest Talk. It is April 16th, 2015, and because it's April 16th, 2015, I have with me Justin Klein.
Is this the date that I'm supposed to be on?
That's, I guess.
Is a special date?
I'm making up as I go.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with that. This is above average investing for the average investor. The average investor tends, and of course you people listening to the show are not necessarily average, but the average investor tends to do many things wrong. And most of it is because they're driven by their emotions.
And uneducated in a lot of ways. You know, they don't know what they don't know.
Yeah, they become overconfident because they think if the markets go, and when they think that since they're making money when the market's going up, that they know more than they really do. Because rising market means almost everything goes up, but that's very, very, very dangerous. They may be thinking that it's like gambling. Well, it's not. Buying and selling stocks is not gambling. There's kind of an element of the unknown, of the risk involved, of the excitement of having a winner or the disappointment of having a loser. But stocks go up because earnings go up. I mean, I've said that a bazillion times, and it's just how it works. Now, I've also said that it's never a perfect relationship. Stocks don't go up every time earnings go up, but if earnings keep going up, the stock will eventually rise. That's how it works. Now, the constant movement of the economy and prices, sentiment, monetary policy, fiscal policy, demographics, industry dynamics, all that means that it's a change in reality, but you can boil it all down to stocks go up when earnings go up. But you still have to know.
It's all about the fundamentals.
The fundamentals of the company. So, you got to have some discipline about this. And that's really what this show is about, is try to help you with some of that discipline. We'll give you some knowledge and help you with some discipline to understand why you're invested in the stock and is it a good time to be investing in that stock. And that's what we want to help you with.
Well, and it could just be an asset class in general. A lot of people are using ETFs nowadays, indexes, those type of things. And I think it's... I don't say rare, but commonly, many investors don't understand exactly what they're investing in, what type of risk they're taking with whatever they're putting their money in, whether it's an individual stock or a broad asset category or index.
So we want to help you improve your odds. That's what we want to do. Your questions are always come first. General questions about stocks or strategy, anything financial, we're here to try to help answer those questions and maybe give you some more knowledge.
Yeah, we like those broad questions that are beyond just one individual stock.
You can also call during any time, Monday through Friday, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But we're live Monday through Friday from 4 to 5 Pacific time. 888-99-CHART is how to reach us, and you can do it right now.
Yes, my name is Don. I'm from Endicott, New York. I'm a podcast listener, and I absolutely love your show. I have two questions. The next pullback, I'm going to be looking at getting a technology ETF. And I was wondering, with them being so many of them, what area of the technology do you think is going to be the most growth in the next year so I can narrow my choice down and make the right one? And my second question is on the stock Norfolk Southern. N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, and C as in Charles. I like this stock, and I'd like to buy it, but at what price do you think is a good price for it to buy it? All right, I'll be listening. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Well, in the tech sector, I like the sphere. I like the space of cloud computing. I still do. I like the server farms. There's certain areas over there that I think are just going to continue to expand long term. Justin, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to pick one particular area of the technology space. I mean, there's so many. You know, you talk about cloud. You talk about there's software. There's hardware. There's service companies. There's security companies. You know, think of the all the hacking that's going on. So there's a lot of, you can slice and dice the technology industry in a lot of different ways. I'm a much bigger fan of just finding the best of the breed. What's the best hardware company out there? What's the best software company out there? And usually when the market goes down a lot, you'll get an opportunity in a lot of those names. So that's the way I would go.
Okay, North Fork Southern is a railroad company, operates a 20,000-mile railroad in 22 states and District of Columbia. And the railroad industry was really good and really hot when oil prices were really high, because it's a lot cheaper to move goods and services through the railroad because it's cheap.
Yeah. And the economy was expanding as well, so that helped.
Well,
the
economy's still expanding that way. Yeah. So they kind of hit on hard times, moving sideways, but not really collapsing or anything.
Yeah, it went from about 117 was the high back in November, and has been making lower highs ever since, and now we're right around the $100 mark.
So it looks like a lot of support right around the $100 mark.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it is making now lower lows. You have lower highs, lower lows. From a technical perspective, that's definitely not a positive sign.
Yeah, what I would actually watch is oil prices. If they continue to move up, I'm not convinced they are, but they will eventually. Maybe railroads will benefit from that.
But I mean, while that is a growth driver for their earnings, remember the bulk of their business is really moving normal goods, and as you've seen with industrial production, our manufacturing sector, if you look at the what's going on recently with the economic numbers that are coming out, they're pretty weak because of the strong dollar. So our exports are falling. There's more competition from overseas producers of goods and services. So that's going to hurt the railroads' stocks, and that's why you see the transportation index weak, companies like Norfolk Southern weak. So I think in the near term, I would be worried about them.
Well, I think the economy is actually going to rebound the rest of the year. I don't think it's all.
Well, I think as long as the dollar stays strong, it's showing you that you're not going to have a rebound in at least the manufacturing sector. And if you look at all the indicators, show that the manufacturing sector is still on its heels now. Like you said, it could turn around.
I agree with you on that. But remember, this is a railroad company that's inside the United States, moving goods within the United States.
Yes.
So it will also
move goods to ports to be exported.
Exactly. So when the goods come from outside the United States, they got to move them inland.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm kind of not too down about that. It's a hard call, but I kind of long term, 5-10 years, I don't think you can go wrong with Norfolk.
Yeah, but I think in the short to medium term, there's a lot of risk.
Yeah, there's a lot of risk. I would agree with that. 888-99 Charter is our number. 888-992-4278. Active management is likely to become increasingly important to achieving sufficient returns. In other words, buying index funds, which have been in vogue for several years, may be changing. That's going to be one of our main talking points today. It's an article we'll be referring to on our website. Also, reasons for taking Social Security early.
There are actually
five reasons. I'm reading a book, I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, about Social Security, and there's a chapter on why you should take money early, because most of the book is on, wait, don't take it early, ever. But there are reasons, and I'm going to go over them with you. Housing starts perked up today for the month of March. Well, I want to talk about that a little bit. What were the statistics? And when I say perk up, how much? Buying currencies, some factors that you really need to pay attention to buying currencies. Everybody's been thinking about they can trade currencies because it's, you could do it through ETFs, and it's very popular, and it's getting more popular. I think we need to discuss some of the reasons some of the pitfalls and problems in buying currencies. Some of the things you got to watch out for that a lot of people I don't think are.
I think the biggest thing with currencies is that it's a zero-sum game.
Well, we'll talk about that. 888-99-CHART is our number. The market today was down, but it wasn't down very much. The Dow was down 7, the Nasdaq down 3, and the S&P down 2. Wasn't very weak.
Yeah. What is surprising? Very modest down day.
Yeah, pretty modest. What has surprised me is their earnings are actually not as bad as all they predicted. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people. And that's what's holding up the market. Their earnings are better than expected. But try to remember, the expectations were downgraded heavily over the quarter. So, just because they come in above expectations doesn't mean it's really good earnings.
Yeah. Well, the Beginning of the quarter, there was expectations of, what, about a 4% earnings growth? Mm-hmm. And now we're at about a negative 2% earnings growth. So it'll be interesting to see how far are we through earnings season?
Right not now, even halfway.
Not even halfway, yeah. So we got a while.
Yeah, so you got more to come. So we'll see.
So probably by what, end of the month will be?
That'll be about three quarters by the end of the month.
And then you get a wide enough swath where you're really going to know where we stand.
One of the services we provide to our listeners is our individual retirement reviews. They're offered on a first-come, first-served basis. I schedule just a few a month. Each month I do it. So they're very informal. We need, we can meet at KPP Financial satellite office in the Bay Area or San Diego. And, of course, our office in San Juan Capistrano. Or we can do it through Skype or even on telephone. If you're outside the state of California, we can still meet. We can do it through Skype or telephone, and I can talk about and review your portfolio and tell you what we have available and see if there's a match. Be happy to do that. Just go to investtalk.com and click on schedule a meeting. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. So why do we think why does this article suggest that the market is going to be attractive to actively managed accounts or managers of accounts as opposed to just indexing? And the article is by Christina Hooper and from Allianz Global Investors. And her thesis is that there's going to be a lot more volatility, that the end of QE kind of has put a retardant on a surging U.S. stock market, and it's going to be a lot more up and down movement instead of just, and it's going to be up to you picking the proper stocks, not just the index.
And probably more likely the proper sector. And I think it makes a lot of sense because, we've had a pullback of over 10% for almost 3 years now.
It was 2000, summer 2011, 19% pullback in that summer.
Yeah, 4 years basically. Is the last time. And so what happens in those type of scenarios is the indexes, everything kind of goes up in lockstep. There's not a real big divergence between sectors and companies because the rising tide just lifts all boats and it lifts them all generally in the same direction and for generally the same magnitude. So all the indexes look like they're doing great. And that's why you've seen, I think, a rise in the indexing strategy. Oh, everyone should just index, and that's all you need to do. Well, I guarantee you, the next bear market we see, nobody's going to want to be indexing.
This just reminds me of the late 1990s. Yeah. Everybody wanted to get into dot-coms because that's what was working. Yep. And then was buy and hold. Everything was buy and hold, just buy and hold. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you had the dot-com implosion. Mm-hmm. And then it was all of a sudden, buy and hold is dead. Well, and see, we're doing the same thing, different type of same thing, though.
It's what all the academics call recency bias. Everyone looks at, the last 2, 3, 4 years, that's what they think the market is. Whether it's good or bad, that's the way they react, and that's the way they rejigger their portfolio. But 9 times out of 10, what happened the last 3, 4 years is going to be very different than what's going to happen the next 3 or 4 years.
And, we see that in our own portfolio.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The market's up a little over 1%, and we've done much better than that.
Yeah.
Because of particular stock selection.
Yeah. Whereas the fourth quarter of last year couldn't have quite that outperformance, returned. So really, you have to judge strategies over a long length of time, not just a short year or two.
You're listening to Invest Talk. Coming up on the second half of Invest Talk today, Peter the Planner will address trouble many of us have talking about money and why it's so important. I'm Steve Peasley with Justin Klein, and you're listening to questions and answers from on Invest Talk here. Our number, 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. Do you know someone who might enjoy this podcast? Why not pass along the suggestion? And if you have a question that you'd like to ask Steve or Justin directly, just click on Contact Steve or Contact Justin right there on investtalk.com, and they will respond.
InvestTalk is a two-way conversation, everybody. But if you have a question between programs and we don't want to do it two-way, you can still call and ask a question. We'll answer it on the very next program. Again, the number is always the same, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Steve and Justin. This is Eva from New York. I was wondering what you think of the stock WeProg, symbol LF. I was wondering if you think it's a good time to buy it or what you think of the company. I'll listen for your answer. Thanks very much. Love the podcast. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind words. This is not a very big company, LeapFrog Enterprises. It's a $160 million company. So that's pretty darn small. That's a microcap kind of. Maybe not a microcap, but pretty darn small. It manufactures technology-based educational products and related content for infants to young children.
Well, it used to be a pretty big company back when it was trading at $12 a share, so at about 6 times what it is now. So you're talking about, at that point, almost a $1 billion company.
Right.
Now it's only $160 million because now it's trading at $2.28. And the reason is that because they used to earn 58 cents a share, and this year they're supposed to lose 72 cents a share.
And then next year lose another 37 cents a share. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sales have been falling very strongly. Mm-hmm. Down 23% last quarter, quarter before, down 43%. It's been averaging 20 to 40% for the last year, 5 quarters. So there's your problem. There, it's clear as can be. That's the problem. Why would you want to own this company if it's going to lose money next year?
Yeah, they still, and they've been losing money the last 4 quarters. So they're definitely struggling. You know, 2014 they were still profitable, but why are analysts saying they're going to lose 72 cents a share? And to me, the biggest reason is what they do is they sell education products and on their own platform with their own content, etc. And what's all these kids using and what are they moving to? iPads, iPhones, iPods. You know, that's where they're getting their products for education purposes, entertainment purposes, and you know it's a very competitive space. And I like their product. I bought their products as gifts for my nieces and nephews and things like that. But you know, it's just a very competitive space, and it's hard to have good margins. Their margins have fallen from.
Look at the return on equity; it's 3%. I mean, it's too small. Yeah. So they're not going to make any money. Margins are shrinking. No, look for something better. This is not good enough.
Yeah, and the chart doesn't look good either.
And they have good products. We're not saying they don't, but it doesn't matter.
It's a competitive space.
Yeah. 888-99-CHART, reasons for taking Social Security early. So early means, you know, you have your full retirement age, whatever that is, 66, 67. But you can start taking Social Security benefits early, as early as 62. But there are some reasons to do that. One, the first one I have is because you need the money. That is a reason.
You say you need the money, it means you desperately need the money. It'd be really nice if I had that money.
Yeah, you lost your job and you need money.
Yeah, you're going to be on the street if you don't or something like that.
Medical condition is another reason. Your health, you're in poor health, and you may not live to full retirement age or even to 70 when you should wait for it.
Yeah.
So you want to take the money.
Because that's ultimately the goal of waiting a little bit longer is that, yes, you'll forgo that payments from 62 to 66 or 70 or whatever, but that you'll make that up over time as you live longer and you get a higher payment. But if you're, like you said, in poor health and you're probably not going to live to 75, well, you should probably take it early.
Now, those two reasons are very easy and clear to delineate. The next three reasons are not so simple. Applying early, if you're married, applying early may make your older spouse eligible for spousal benefits on your earnings. So let's say your older spouse is 66 and you're 62 and you make a lot of money. You can apply at 62 and suspend. In other words, you apply for Social Security benefits, but you don't take them. Your spouse can then apply for spousal benefit, and he or she will get half of what your normal Social Security benefit is. Then your Social Security, as you grow older, you take it at 70, you can now get your Social Security, and that spousal goes away.
And that doesn't affect your ultimate payout.
Does not affect you. Meanwhile, for a number of years, you get to collect half. Your spouse gets to collect half of your benefits. It's called spousal benefits. It's a little bit more tricky. Also, it enables a younger or disabled child to begin collecting children's benefits. Because if you file early and suspend, they have a child benefit if they are disabled. There's another reason. See, this starts to get a little not so clear.
So how much is the child benefit? If a spousal is half, what's the child benefit?
It depends on the salary, income, and the full
benefits.
There's
not a general rule of 25% or something like that?
It's so, about 50%.
About 50. Oh, so that's about the same.
Yeah.
So, and any child you have, doesn't matter their age, can get that child benefit.
Correct. Interesting. Well, I'm not sure about that age part. Okay. If they're 5, I don't know.
Yeah.
If widowed, taking your retirement benefit early and then wait until your full retirement age to take survivor's benefits. There's a survivor benefit. And it may be worth it to start taking it early. You have to look at all the benefits. In other words, you again suspend your own, but if you were widowed and the other spouse died, they have benefits that you might be entitled to.
You're saying it's more complex than most people think.
Exactly. InvestTalk will continue with Pete Dunne. Peter Dunne, also known as Peter the Planner, he's an award-winning comedian and financial mind, and he has some solutions to age-old money problems that you should find pretty interesting. Coming up next on InvestTalk. Well, we welcome Peter Dunne, also known as Peter the Planner, to InvestTalk. Peter is an award-winning comedian and financial mind. He serves as a spokesperson for One American Retirement Services on financial wellness topics, helping participants find financial stability so they can prepare for the future, something we do every day on this show. He's the author of 10 books. 6 of them were featured in a nationwide launch on Barnes & Noble stores in January, just this last January. He is the host of a popular radio show, The Pete the Planner Show, on 93 WIBC-FM, and is a columnist for the Indy Star. And Pete has appeared regularly on CNN Headline News, Fox Business, as well as numerous national syndicated radio programs, so he's got a pretty good resume. In 2012, Sisson named Pete the 4th most influential financial broadcasters in the nation. So we're really glad to have Peter back here on InvestTalk. Welcome, Pete. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good to be back with you guys.
Now, there's that's kind of an interesting combination, a comedian and a financial expert, and there's not much money about money, so how'd that come about?
Well, the reality is it's such an uncomfortable topic for people that sometimes you can either choose to cry or to laugh, and I don't want to sit in a room full of people and tear up. I'd rather make them laugh, so it actually works out pretty well.
Well, good for you. I appreciate it. Justin Klein's here, and he's got a load of questions, as well as I do. But go ahead, Justin.
I think, in today's day and age where, you have wage growth kind of stagnant for a lot of reasons, a lot of people have trouble affording certain things, whether it's a trip or a new car or whatever. How do you, when you talk to your listeners and the people that you talk to on a regular basis, how do you explain to them how they can figure out if they can afford something? How do they get to that point where they're, okay, I can do this, I can afford to do this or buy this?
Yeah, here's the reality. Most people turn to the people they're borrowing from to determine if they can afford what they're trying to borrow. And in the bank situation, you go and say, hey, can I afford this? And
sure.
exactly, Steve. They let us afford more than we should. So I have a terrible answer for that, Justin. Here's my answer. When the bank says you can't afford it, you definitely can't afford it. And when the bank says you can afford it, there's a chance you probably still can't afford it.
Yeah. And when it comes to homes, that's notorious. I know we have an employee at our company who's actually looking to buy a home, and he just got married, and he put in into the financial calculator on some site to see how much home they could afford. And it said something close to $1 million home. And he's like, I'm not even comfortable going much more than half of that. And it's pretty interesting to see what those calculators will say, even though somebody who is financially savvy and literate would know that's definitely far, far higher than what they really should be spending. So what should an average person spend on their housing?
Outside of the top 10 metropolitan areas in the country, the answer is about 25% of take-home pay. But once you get into San Diego, San Francisco, New York, Boston, Hawaii, or Honolulu, you start to, the numbers creep up. 40% still is about where it should top out. Because the reality is, that's one expense of the, you know, 15 core expenses we all have. And any more than that, you're definitely going to bring a lot of financial stress to the situation.
Yeah, I'm probably older than both you guys. And the old rule that I lived by for years and years and years was about 30%. No more than 33% of your take-home pay should you be paying out in a mortgage. And that included property tax.
Yeah, but that also doesn't include insurance.
No, not all.
HOAs nowadays that are a big part of owning a home.
Not PMI either.
Yeah.
You know, which, if no one knows what that means, that's something. Anyway, how about, you know, a lot of young people have student loans. Would you still recommend that a person go to college and embrace a student loan to do so? Or what is your advice on that topic?
Yeah, no, I like people to see how they can reduce the cost of the attendance of college before they even get involved with student loans. Look, what I'm about to say is wildly unpopular, but it's very true. And I speak at college campuses all the time. It's that, you know, a commuter student can exit school with 50% less student loans than a student that decides to live on campus. And while I know the college experience is about the college experience as much as it is the education, these days, with jobs how they are, with wages as they are, I'm not willing to exit school with an excess of $30,000 in student loan. It's a car you can't drive, and the amortization table for that really restricts a lot of young professionals' ability to get off to the right start.
And I'm not sure why parents allow their children to go out of state college for out-of-state tuition when the first 2 years they could send them to a community college and have the same education, then this last 2 years go get your degree somewhere. I don't understand that. And I have that happening all the time in my family, by the way. I have two family members doing that exact thing right now.
You know, so, one of the dirty tricks that's going on right now, guys, is that public colleges are recruiting stronger than ever out of state as a financial policy of the university. They said, look, we don't want in-state tuition dollars. We're going to open it up and really recruit out-of-state students. I'm from Indiana, and in Bloomington, Indiana, IU University has a concerted effort to attract students from the East Coast because they want the East Coast money, and they're less concerned about educating the students specifically that are in state.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. And you know, you talk about that, but a lot of those kids that are going to college, they usually go into college not very educated about finances because they're not taught how to think about interest and budgeting, et cetera, when they're in K through 12 education. Now, when you talk to parents about educating their kids, whether they're, you know, very young, talking, you know, 3 to 8 years old, or, you know, when they get into their teens and even post-graduation, a lot of times you still have to educate your kids. How do you talk to parents about how they should approach getting their kids ready for the real world, starting from when they're very young?
I love this question because I always imagine a parent, you know, taking a long drag on a cigarette and saying, listen, kids, don't smoke, you know, because ultimately...
That was my parents.
Yeah, that's ultimately what happens, and kids are going to watch what their parents do, but I think the conversation starts with credit scores, but not the way you guys are thinking. I think we're way too fixated on credit scores in this country. The credit bureaus are for-profit businesses that take our data without our permission and sell it to other people, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist. That's just reality, and so we're not the consumer of the credit bureaus. We are the product of the credit bureaus, and so I think students need to know that we shouldn't pander and dance around to build our credit scores. We should have good financial habits that build a healthy credit score, but parents are sucked in, just like everyone else, to do the credit score dance, and I think that's a really damaging thing for someone that's already graduating with $30,000 in student loans.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, one of your books you have is called What Your Dad Never Taught You About Budgeting. So What does this book kind of entail, and what are the things that you talk to people about that are maybe a little bit different and really eye-opening for some people that cause them to make much better financial decisions in the long run?
Yeah, I think the 1980s changed budgeting forever. You guys know the statistics in our industry. A 2007 study showed that in 1975, 88% of the private sector had a pension. I still call baloney on that number, but that's the real study, 88% private in 1975. Now it's less than 10%, so budgeting has changed because we are forced to fund our own retirements, as we should be. And so we have to re-grip and think of budgeting different. Our parents grew up at a time when they were most likely supported by a pension. We aren't, so we must adjust.
Yeah, and you're talking especially like how you address retirement and how you have to plan for yourself. And a lot of times you have to figure out how to invest, whether it's through your 401k, an IRA, et cetera. And many people are not prepared to invest properly. And so you talk on – I saw on your site you actually have an article. You talk about five attributes of a good financial advisor. So if someone's going out and looking for a financial advisor, we get this question all the time. Obviously, we are financial advisors, but we want people to be prepared, whether it's us or somebody else. You need to kind of have a goal of what to look for. Now, what do you tell people when they're looking for financial advisors to look for?
Yeah, I mean, I like people that frankly develop their own content and perspective on the industry. I think in an industry dominated by large firms, when you just are a mouthpiece of a large firm as an advisor, how much value does that bring to your client? So I like free-thinking advisors that are willing to challenge the status quo. And frankly, as you guys know, sometimes our compliance departments dictate whether we're able to do that or not.
Yeah.
But I like advisors that are willing to have strange conversations because it's motivating people to do the right thing that's the difference, not just telling them the numbers.
Yeah, and number four on your list is about risk radar, and I think that kind of ties into what you're saying, whereas a lot of the big brokerage firms, they kind of push the book of the firm as opposed to really focusing on the client, and you know, I think a good advisor, which is something we do, is find out the risk tolerance of a particular person and invest them accordingly so it's for them, not just for the book of the business that they're running.
We also here at InvestTalk, you know, one of the things that we do and we like a lot, and I know you support it too, is we like to teach. I have no problem trying to teach somebody how to do it themselves. If they have the interest, the time, the desire, they can do it. They just need to put the time in. So we are teachers. Even in our conferences, it's nothing but teaching. And I do think that's important. And I saw on your website that you thought that was important as well.
Yeah, I do. I mean, paying for a professional service and having it done well is one of the great pleasures of America, you know, to be able to get someone to do something that you can't or not willing to do. And so that teaching aspect is important. And I think a good advisor is willing to turn an account over to the client themselves if they want to try to do it themselves, but is there to step in and assist when necessary.
Well, Pete, I really appreciate you being with us. You had some really good information. And everybody, Pete has a number of books. The one I like is What Your Dad Never Taught You About Budgeting. That's one of my favorite ones because I have a large family, Peter, and no one, my wife has nine brothers and sisters. I have four brothers. No one of them teach their kids about money. None of them. So that's what the book I'm going to get, I think, and start passing.
I think one of the most interesting ones he has is called The Commissioner, for people that live on a commission basis. They don't have a regular salary, and maybe they're 100% commission. Mm-hmm. I think, is that a pretty popular book for you, Pete?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the only books that exist for people with a variable income.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have a moving target when you have a variable income. You have a varying amount of arrows, and that's the problem. So the book just shows you how to take aim when you don't know how many arrows you have in the quiver.
Peter, thank you for spending some time with us here on InvestTalk. You can see more about Pete the Planner by visiting his website, PeteThePlanner.com. Best stinking money blog on the internet, it says. Practical money advice for real people. And look for his books at Barnes & Noble. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. 888-99-CHART is our number, everybody. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions or if you want to talk about anything financial. That's what we're here for. So give us a call.
Find out more about KPP Financial's Balanced Income Program, designed to accommodate investors who have a lower risk tolerance but still desire some exposure to the potential growth of the stock market. Check it out now on investtalk.com. Click on the Investments tab.
Thank you. Linda calling from San Jose. I love the program, and we are looking for some more dividends. We were looking at Mark West Energy, MWE. How safe do you think this is? And if you'd give an opinion, love to hear it. Thank you very much.
Well, you can't use the word safe, okay? This is Mark West Energy Partners, a master limited partnership engaged in the gathering, compressing, treating, processing, and transportation of natural gas in the United States. I don't like to use the word safe in any stocks. Mm-hmm. And the higher the multiples, the less safe it is.
And in this industry, as you've seen with oil prices, it can be pretty volatile. And, you know, it's one thing you have to understand with any master limited partnership is the tax consequences are different. So the 5.54% yield you're getting on this particular security is different than maybe a 5.4% yield you might get on AT&T, right? Because it's taxed, they're taxed differently. So that's important as well. And this is, like I said, can be a volatile industry. And right now, the payout ratio is almost 500%, meaning they're only earning about 72 cents a share over the last 12 months, and they're paying out $3.50 a share.
They're going to make 80 cents a share, and they have over 5% dividend yield, and it's a $67 stock. That means they'd have to make $3.50 a share to pay out all their earnings to pay 5% based on that stock price. Mm-hmm. That's not possible. So two things can happen. They have to reduce their dividend, or they're going to have to borrow the money or gather the money or issue more shares. They got to do something up that dividend.
They've been issuing more shares. Their share count has gone from 22 million shares in 2005 up to 186 million shares today. So it's grown every single year.
That means
so.
You're just giving back your own money.
Exactly.
Not a
smart allocation strategy from the company. So not a name I would be investing in.
We're coming up on the last segment of the program. Let's try to get your question in if we can. Call us at 888-99-CHART.
Here's another benefit when you sign up for our InvestTalk Insider program, a brief list of real estate investment trusts, REITs, that should be on investors' radar if they're looking for exposure to this dividend-focused sector. You can sign up for this free InvestTalk Insider program on investtalk.com. Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. Coming up on the next InvestTalk, 51% of managers surveyed believe Europe is the best place to park money in stocks over the next year. The bulls are running toward Europe. That's our talking point for Friday, April 17th. We hope you'll listen to that podcast.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. So, housing starts were reported today for March, and they perked up a little bit. They're up 2% in March. That's to 926,000 starts. Now, the expectation was for a little over 1 million starts.
So it was disappointing.
So it was a little disappointing. But do you know what the average was over the last 20 years? Before the stock market took that financial crisis and we went into recession. Do you know what the 20-year average of how many houses we built a year? 20 years, on average, we built 1.5 million houses a year. And we have not, if we got to 1 million maybe once or twice, I mean, very, we haven't seen that. It's just not there. So what does that mean? Is it, and I was thinking about this, and I think it's all Justin's fault.
Mm-hmm, it's all my fault.
It's all the millennials' fault.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the student loans we talked about with Pete the Planner a little bit earlier. And, you know, a lot of the Generation Y, I know many, many people that are spending $1,000 plus a month on student loan repayments. That's now, almost a mortgage in itself.
I'll give it to you that that's part of the problem. I agree. That is.
I think that's a big part of the problem.
But I also think that millennials are waiting a lot longer to get married and start a family.
That's true. So there's less incentive. Yeah, because, you know, so, like our employee, he just got married and he's now looking to buy a house. So, yeah, it was an impetus for him to start buying a house.
Yeah, so I'm not saying the student loans aren't a problem. I think that is a big part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I'll say more than 50% of the problem.
Yep.
But I also think it's just a little bit of cultural shift we're having. And I don't think the cultural shift is going to go away. I think this is the way it's going to be. So I don't expect housing starts to be much more. I don't see them go back to 1.5 million. I just don't.
Yeah, well, you also have to think as well is think about the people that had foreclosures in the past 10 years that are going to have trouble getting a mortgage, or maybe they're just scarred from the experience of buying a house and they don't want to go out and lock themselves into an asset like that in a mortgage payment.
And that goes back to what we were talking to Pete the Planner about, and that is how much can you afford?
Mm-hmm.
And he said 25%, and it's some of the very expensive areas, no more than 40% of your monthly take-home pay or income should go to or toward a mortgage.
Mm-hmm. And then you're talking about household formation. Formation is, while it's still improving, is nowhere near where it was, you know, like you said, over the past 20 years or so. So there isn't that demand for as many homes. So it's one of those things where I think, like you said, it's going to be a slow slog.
Yeah, it don't expect it to go back to 1.5 million. I just don't see it. But it is improving. It's not all the news is not bad. It is improving. We're live 4 to 5 Pacific time each day, Monday through Friday. If you're listening at that time, you certainly can talk to us live at 888-99-CHART. Chart, CHART. If you're not with us then, you can always call our 24-hour listener line.
Hi, Steve and Justin. I'm a podcast listener. Thanks for doing the program. Enjoy it very much. My question is pretty simple. Why do you sometimes recommend that you wait till a stock breaks a new high before purchasing? It seems somewhat counter to, I guess, the point where you'd want to enter. Thank you very much. I'll hang up and listen.
And this is a matter of reading charts. Basically, that's what it is. It's in the charts that we're talking about. When it breaks out, that's called a breakout to a new high, trends tend to stay in place for long periods of time. So we're saying if it's a breakout, it'll tend to continue to break out.
Yeah. I think a lot of it depends on the stock, the market. It depends on how long it's been around that new high. If something is what we call consolidating, meaning it's trading around that new high for a long time, right, it's trying to break above it for many months, and then it finally breaks above it, then it has the power to really start to move. But if it hasn't been hanging around, it just goes all the way up to it and maybe pokes its head above that into a new high, then that's just still probably a lot of resistance. It's probably going to fail. So it depends.
Yeah, so just talking about the nuances of reading charts.
There you go. Yeah, I like
that. It's not that simple.
Yeah, not that simple at all.
Before we close the hour, a reminder to sign up for our InvestTalk Insider program. It's free, and it gives you access to all sorts of information, helpful info sheets, and my monthly economic forecasts. It's easy to register. Just go to InvestTalk.com. I'm Portfolio Manager Steve Peasley with Justin Klein, and everybody at KPP Financial wants to thank you for listening today, and let's do it again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.